Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, helping to make Easter dinner easy with ready-to-heat and serve citrus-glazed ham, au gratin potatoes, deviled eggs, and pastry trays. Make it easy with Harmon's.
For just a second, think about the word intimacy. Now, how would you define it? The evolutionary biologist Justin Garcia says it's harder than it sounds. Intimacy is easy to talk about as a feeling. It's harder to pin down as a scientific idea. But he says it is something you can study, something you can measure. In his new book, he says intimacy is feeling safe enough to lower your emotional armor and expose your deepest insecurities. It's the experience of closeness, of feeling and being seen and heard and known. And it's not abstract. It's a primal urge, like the other primal urge, the sex drive. Garcia says we have an intimacy drive. In his book, he writes about a moment that seemed pretty close to evidence for this. Garcia is the director of the Kinsey Institute. It's the research center that studies human sexuality and relationships. And he had gone to Pahrump, Nevada to do some field research at a brothel. The brothels in Pahrump are legal.
It's not the easiest place to get to. You have to make a decision that you're going to spend an afternoon going out there. And we had a tour from the folks who were there at this legal brothel. It was a beautiful facility. It was clean. They were answering our questions. They knew we were a team of scientists. And the woman who was giving us a tour had a little menu set up and talked us through the different kinds of things that people would come to this legal brothel for. Some of the things you might expect. There were different kink-related exercises or activities you could engage in. You could get an oil massage. There were themed rooms and rules about hygiene for customers. Women could reject the men that came in. They didn't have to say yes to a potential client. They also set their own prices. There's a lot of nuance there, I think more than we may realize. So that was kind of standard, what you would expect. People go to a brothel to pay for sexual activity. But the part that really stuck out to me was that when we looked at this menu, the most expensive item on the menu, at the very bottom of it, something called the white whale. We asked the woman giving us the tour, what is that exactly? And she said, oh, and that's the girlfriend experience. Basically a date. You would pay to have a bottle or two of champagne. You would have dinner, spending time talking, getting to know each other, being comfortable. It was not just an hour session of presumably sexual activity. It was couching any sexual activity, if it happened at all, in terms of almost a date. It was in some ways confirming questions I had been thinking about. I had been at the time writing about hookup culture and hookup casual sex behavior. And the questions I was asking were, how were people finding intimacy in seemingly casual sex? So I was asking these questions about intersections of love and sex, or where intimacy was existing, even in context that perhaps didn't seem intimate. I assumed that that would be in the mix. What struck me silent was that in one of the few places where sex work is legal, this enormous facility, all these themed rooms, and of all of the different fantasies that they could fulfill, the thing people were willing to spend the most money on was a fantasy that couched sexual activity in terms of intimacy, in terms of a date and connection. That is what the human animal desired most. Just sex that felt a little bit like you were also connecting with the person in some way. But it made sense, and it does highlight the profound power and influence of our intimacy drive in ways that I was just starting to piece together.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Justin Garcia's book is called The Intimate Animal, and in it, he makes the case that sex and relationships aren't just culture or morality. They're rooted deep in our evolutionary past. He says if you want to understand why we love or commit or swipe or cheat, you have to start with the biology of being human. And that means looking for patterns in how living things behave, which is a habit Garcia picked up early as a kid watching the insect world, ants in particular.
I've always been interested in the natural world. Growing up as a kid, I watched a lot of nature shows. I grew up near the water, so I loved being in the water. But often when we were at the shore, I was interested in like digging for sand crabs and looking for what had washed up on the shore or going fishing. I was just always interested in the world around us. Ants, as it turns out, are very well studied by evolutionary biologists. And in part because they have fairly complex social behaviors. They have social caste and roles in many and most ant species. Mm. And they have the way that genetic inheritance operates in ants is really interesting. And when you think about the process of natural and sexual selection, in terms of how they're all related to each other and how the castes are related to each other. So they're a really interesting model. And what's funny about it now, at this point in my career where I work on sexuality and relationships, often I'll get asked, when did I get interested in this work? Or I'll get asked, what was my own sex education background? In part because there's so many questions about the state of sexual literacy and sex and relationship education, particularly for young people. And I laugh because we had a pretty open household and we talked pretty openly about health and well-being. But because I watched so many nature documentaries and read so many books about animals and like I remember saying to my mom once, I was like, I don't remember us having like real intense birds and bees conversations. And she said, no, I think you picked it up from all the nature shows along the way.
Yeah.
Which interestingly has colored my whole career. And what I mean by that is most people who study sexuality and relationships are formally trained as psychologists and sociologists. My training is as an evolutionary biologist and anthropologist. I came at the whole topic, even studying human sexuality and intimacy, I came at it through a very different lens.
Right.
Now, at times, that lens put me at a disadvantage. I wasn't always speaking the same language as the majority of my colleagues. And at other times, I think it offered a very different way to ask new questions and bring new methods, innovate in different ways. So it was like anything, when you bring a lot of diversity of backgrounds and experiences, you bring some weaknesses and you bring a lot of new strengths as well. So it's been a fun journey since I was a kid looking at ants in the driveway to thinking about how that natural world plays out in social behavior more generally and then more focused on mating behavior.
What is it that interested you and interests you in that intersection between evolutionary biology and human social and intimate behavior? What interests you about that? Like just discovering where it comes from, where the impulse are, how we adapted these impulses? Like what is it for you?
Mm-hmm. I was interested in evolutionary theory as a meta theory, as a framework that unifies how we think of the world, how we think of our existence. And I was, in the traditional sense, interested in human evolution. So when did our species evolve? How did it evolve? How did it come to dominate across the globe? And as a biologist and anthropologist, I was interested in how is it there are some things that are universal, some behaviors, some traits that are universal, and then other things that vary so much by context,
right,
by what we call ecology,
yeah,
different cultures, different time periods. And what I stumbled upon was this question about when pair bonding evolved in humans around 4 to 4.4 million years ago in our hominin ancestors, that we saw the evolution of pair bonding, what we would call romantic love. Only about 3 to 5% of mammals engage in pair bonds. And that's what got me started. And then something about this question of pair bonding and the power of love, and it did relate to something in my personal life that I shared in the book, in The Intimate Animal, was watching my cousin Jen and her husband, Dave, manage illness and the power of their relationship. And I was really thinking of it in that sense in terms of social behavior. Like, wow, isn't that amazing how powerful love bonds are and how we can support each other through really hard times? And then it just started to come together.
Did you at all think about it in the context of, I wonder what technology and social media and dating apps are going to mean for human intimacy and how we are going to adapt to all of that? Like, did that at all come into it, at least in those early days? Were you thinking about it in that context?
Not then, actually, a little bit, but a few years later it did. And dating apps that were just becoming popular at that time, well, I shouldn't say they were already out for well over a decade, but they were becoming more popular. And the question that actually really got me started was I was working with a psychologist, Anne Merriweather, who I still work and publish with, and she had was interested in something about hookup culture. And I remember talking one day and I said, you know, how do we make this make sense? How do we jive the theory about that humans have been engaging in pair bonds for 4 million years, that love is perhaps adaptive, it has an evolutionary function, with, like, we're on a college campus. Let's look around. All these young people are having hookups. They're having casual sex. Yeah. There's, you know, friends with benefits, no strings attached. There were more movies. Researchers were just starting to write about hookups. I think when I first took a look, there were like 4 papers. You could learn the whole literature in an afternoon. So I was interested in how do we reconcile that? How do we reconcile this notion that we fall in love with also this seeming casual sex behavior everywhere on a university campus? So that was what really got me started. And later what that turned into is I was interested in the role of intimacy. And then my niche in that area was questions of, like, when do they turn into relationships? Yeah. Do people fall in love and catch feelings? What are your real motivations for these? Do you spend the night and cuddle? It turns out one of our papers we found pretty high rates, about 2/3 of people will spend the night and cuddle after seemingly uncommitted casual sex. That to me said something else is going on here that we're not really talking about.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that central idea, the importance of intimacy. You say in the book that few of us understand the essential drive of intimacy. So explain what you mean there, because you say intimacy lives in the shadow of that other primal urge, the sex drive. So are you saying that we don't actually think of intimacy as an actual primal urge?
I think that's right. And that's been my experience that we... And as scientists in particular, sexual reproduction and sexual activity, we understand, and I say we, I mean researchers from a lot of different backgrounds, but I think also in the general public, we understand that sex isn't part of reproduction, that we evolve desires, sexual desires. It's associated with the ability to pass on our genes to the next generation, and it's evolved in humans like it has in every sexually reproducing animal. The part that I think we've paid less attention to, and I think often not used our scientific lenses as often, is thinking about the context of so much of our human sexual lives. And that's relationships. In fact, research has shown that most sexual activity occurs in long-term relationships, that most reproduction occurs in long-term relationships. Most heartbreak occurs in long-term relationships. So the impact of these bonds on our lives, I think we haven't paid enough attention to. And in fact, studies where anthropologists have looked for examples of romantic love, in every society anthropologists have studied, there's evidence of romantic love, of people's pursuit of it, how people try and manage their love, how they celebrate it, whether they're singing for it or dancing for it or performing for it. It is this great human unifier. And there's no evidence, there's no culture that we know of that doesn't acknowledge or recognize, and in many cases even celebrate aspects of romantic love. So for me, that then said, we've got to think about this differently. We've got to think about this as an evolutionist. If we're using evolutionary theory as a framework to think about how the world is unified and how we make sense of variation and diversity of traits, how we make sense of behaviors that transmit from one generation to the next, okay, we know the sex part for reproduction. Yeah. But what about the role of these relationships? And that's when I really came to see that intimacy, our desire for deep, meaningful connection, to be seen and heard and felt by another person, that had to have some evolutionary aspects to it. It had to be selected for by our ancestors to couch so much of our sexual life. And also, I think more broadly, couch our social life. And that lens then for me helped me understand a lot more about why did love evolve, the power of it in our lives, why it's so painful when we separate it. Yeah. It just gave me a new way to enter thinking about connections in our lives.
Well, here's what you write in the book, like you define intimacy, and I think this is really interesting. You say it's the experience of closeness, of feeling and being seen, heard, and known. That really gets at the idea of connection, doesn't it? The idea of being seen and understood and known, that's intimacy.
Yeah, and I think especially in a moment where we're talking about loneliness epidemics, and I think you asked about technology earlier, I'm sure we'll go back to it, but when I think of the opportunities for technology, what's so interesting is that many of us can log on, or maybe we have a few thousand connections on social media. And in some sense, we're engaging with so many people. We have these social networks, or these, what some people would call connections. And I think the challenge is that all of us forget sometimes that those aren't real intimate bonds for the most part. They're not intimate connections. They're not people that necessarily, you know, maybe you'll write on your social media, hey, I need a new gardener. Anyone have a recommendation? Okay, that's helpful. Mm. But are you really getting the kinds of things, like if you need to be driven to a hospital or if you really need emotional support? Those tend to not be great sources for that. Those are the things, though. Someone who can give you a hug, someone who can give you emotional support. Mm-hmm. That's what this social primate, what the human animal, we crave it and we need it to thrive.
You say that humans have evolved with an intimacy instinct, but also in the pursuit of self-expansion. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a term psychologists use, and it turns out it's very important for relationships, that self-expansion is when we think beyond ourselves and beyond our comfort zone is one way to think of it. And that one of the things we look for in partners are those that help us experience life and the world in new ways. And self-expansion is it allows us to try and experience new things. One of the things we know that's very valuable in relationships, that we're attracted to in relationships, both men and women, all demographics, are partners that aid in our self-expansion, that get us to experience and try new things. Maybe it's them. Maybe we're experiencing a new personality. Maybe it's a new restaurant, a new food, a new place, a new way to communicate. That's a wonderful treat that we can have in relationships. It's kind of an aphrodisiac for relationships, where we can expand ourselves with someone else. And often you need someone else. You need a co-pilot to do it. It can be pretty hard to engage in self-expansion without someone there to guide you or to catch you as you go through that process.
Justin Garcia, he's the executive director of the Kinsey Institute. We're talking about his book, The Intimate Animal, The Science of Sex, Fidelity, and Why We Live and Die for Love. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, helping to make Easter dinner easy with ready-to-heat and serve citrus-glazed ham, au gratin potatoes, deviled eggs, and pastry trays. Make it easy with Harmon's.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about love, the kind that shapes who we are and what we want from each other. We have with us the evolutionary biologist Justin Garcia, who has a new book that tells what research reveals about desire and attachment, you know, why we fall in love. He says humans are driven not just by sex, but by a powerful evolutionary need for intimacy. His book is called The Intimate Animal. I want to come back to something you mentioned, because you write about it early on in the book, that we're at the sort of the heart of a pivotal moment in our sexual evolution. And there's something you write that seems kind of alarming. You write this: there is almost no other society we know of in the cross-cultural literature where so many adults have been single at a given time. Up to 40% of the adult population in the United States alone is single. Talk a little bit about this. Is it alarming to you? Are you confused about why that would be in the context of how we evolved? Like, what do you make of that?
Yeah, and I think for me, what's so interesting is it's so evolutionary unprecedented that we have so many adults who are single. I mean, at scale, we're talking about well over 100 million adults in the United States alone. And we are seeing this pattern now in more and more countries. We're seeing it in a lot of the Western world. more data coming out, for instance, in also in East Asia. Now, in some places, there were explanations. So what we were seeing in China, for instance, there were arguments that, well, people are just working too much. There's something called 996. People are working from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. And if you're working 996, good luck trying to start a relationship or maintain a healthy relationship. But that's not necessarily what we were seeing when we started looking across the globe. And in the U.S., as the driver, it wasn't necessarily just careers. That there was a bunch of stuff going on. People were delaying relationship formation. Now, what would happen 50 years ago in the U.S., for instance, age at first marriage was so much younger.
Right.
So for many people, they would go through a pretty short courtship period. They'd get married, and then they would embark on an adventure together with their spouse. Maybe that was starting a life, building a home, having kids. But what we see for people today is a very different pattern that they think about marriage. So age at marriage is the oldest it's ever been. It's been pushed back further. Age at first birth has been pushed back further. And for many young people, they want to hang out for a while. They want to hang out in social groups with a person, maybe for months before their boyfriend, girlfriend. They could go through that process for years, be engaged for years, maybe live together, then maybe get married. Now, of course, marriage is something different from the biology of love. And marriage is a sort of social legal contract around it. But it does tell us something that this is a big shift in how we think about relationship formation. Whereas people would get into this contract early on, start an adventure. People today, particularly young people, the notion of marriage, it's the grand finale. It's after you know everything about someone. You've researched them. You understand them. You've pressure tested the relationship. And then maybe it's this culminating event. That's a pretty radical change in just a few decades. But the part that I'm alarmed about is that I don't know that we, and I say we, as socially have recognized what are the implications for so many adults being single. Now, many of them are not perpetually single. A lot of people moving in and out of relationships. Some of them are very happy single. But there are a lot of implications for well-being, for psychological loneliness, for health, for a sense of connection, for depression, anxiety, stress, a whole bunch of things are and other studies have found that I think we haven't paid attention to what this demographic shift means for our social lives and our well-being. And we're just starting to chip away at that. But part that alarms me is if this trend in singlehood is just because people are pursuing happiness, oh, that's great. But I don't think that's what the data is showing us. I think it's that more and more people are struggling with establishing and maintaining relationships that make them happy, bring them joy. And that's the part that I worry about.
You tell this story in the book about you're having dinner with your friend and colleague, Elizabeth. And you notice something. She's talking to you. She's chatty and, you say, and effusive. She's overflowing with joy. And you point out she's talking about someone she had met. And you were like, I think you're in love. So let's talk about that part, like why it is humans fall in love. Because one of the things you get at in the book is that I think we think about love as cultural, but you write about it as being tied to neurobiology and a sort of a biological mechanism and evolutionary pressures. So tell us about why humans fall in love and how it fits in that sense.
So you hit on a really important point. And for a long time, social scientists thought that love was this cultural construction and or social construction, that it couldn't be biological, that there was all this social stuff about relationships and marriage. And I think that gets back to, we want to be cautious about not conflating marriage with love. Now, in the best case, a marriage is a loving relationship. And in fact, the data would say that most of them are. But marriage is a social legal contract. That is a construction. But it's a construction ideally around the biology of love, about what happens when we fall in love. So when we look at romantic love, psychologists describe it as focused attention, intrusive thought, obsessive thinking. When we put someone in a brain scanner who's romantically in love, we see unique parts of their brain, particularly tied to their dopamine system, are activated with romantic love. So that's somewhat different than other kinds of love. So there's something unique about romantic love compared to parent-child love or best friend love. And what we know is that, yes, around, you know, in human evolution and human history, there have been moments like the agricultural revolution, which change how relationships are formed and change the politics of the economics of forming relationships and resources. But in that noise, there's also a lot of evidence that people still understood what love was and still desired partners. And I think, for instance, sometimes people will use the example, what about societies that practice arranged marriage? Well, in most societies that practice arranged marriage, if you really didn't like a person, you can say no. And because arranged marriages are being done by families who often have your best interests at heart, they understand that you would say no. I'm not attracted to that person. It's not, not going to work. And some evidence suggests that arranged marriages, after a couple of years, do report fairly high levels of satisfaction, relationship satisfaction, and feelings of love. And there's also evidence, like I've heard some social scientists say, well, isn't, you know, the notion of romantic, courtly love, that was really something from the Middle Ages. And I think even then, there's these examples where we've taken a small number of people, elites in society, where we have good histories, and said, okay, yes, maybe royalty were pairing for resources and power and land. But in those cases, we also know that peasants, people without resources, were always marrying for love because they didn't have pieces of property that they had to worry about trading in a marital arrangement that impacted families. So in all of these cases where we've, I think, mistakenly started to believe that love is just cultural, we actually see there's a lot more going on in the way that people connect and establish relationships and live their lives. And the consistent, the universal in all these different cultures and time periods has been our desire to have intimacy with another person. And it's something deeply ingrained in our biology. It goes back 4 million years.
Well, let me give you a chance to talk about little creatures like voles in this case, for example, because it gets at this, the idea that love produces these kind of intense reward responses in the brain. Like this is what's going on. And like this is the sort of seems to be the thing that's happening when you fall in love. And the prairie voles, the story of the voles, this is work of one of your colleagues, Sue Carter, that you write about. Talk about this, what we learn from voles.
Yeah, thanks for giving me an opportunity to talk about animals again. So Sue Carter's work was a wonderful researcher, a neurobiologist who's worked on oxytocin, the so-called cuddle hormone, and vasopressin, another neuropeptide. And they're deeply involved. Oxytocin's deeply involved in bonding behavior, but it's also deeply involved in reproduction. So oxytocin is what's involved with lactation in mammals. It's important for uterine contractions during birth. So this peptide has a lot of different effects on our biology, particularly around reproductive physiology, but also for bonding. And in what Sue has found and others over the years, but she's really pioneered these studies, is that when we look at two different species of voles, montane voles and prairie voles, prairie voles form socially monogamous pair bonds, montane voles don't. And one of the major differences was the oxytocin system in the brain. And in particular, the density of oxytocin receptors in the brain. And through many different studies looking at different pieces, what we've come to understand is those systems are what encourage social bonding. Now, it doesn't mean they were always sexually exclusive, but they did form these socially monogamous pair bonds. And that you could disrupt those systems, and it changed some of the mating behaviors. And the reason these voles had different behaviors, some social monogamous in the prairie vole and not in the montane vole, had to do with the environments they were in. So evolutionists were interested in how these different species adapted to their environments. And for some, having a pair bond partner allowed them to respond to the environment. Now, when you have two individuals, it means you often need, in some ways, more resources. You need more food. You need more. You're sometimes competing for food. You're competing for a nest. You're trying to avoid predators. So there also can be some challenges for having two individuals, which is perhaps why only 3 to 5% of mammals do this. But there's also opportunity when you have an individual to weather uncertainty in the environment with. And it turns out that these prairie voles much like humans, they're pair bonds. They both take care of young. And in fact, they also take care of each other. There's some examples, for instance, that I write about in The Intimate Animal, of some species where they almost help with the birthing process. Mm. The males are involved in helping with the litters, in some cases pulling them out as the females are giving birth. It's really interesting things we see in the natural world. And then we can start to look at the mechanisms, those shared mechanisms. And like prairie voles, we have fairly developed oxytocin systems in the brain.
So it gets to this, to I think, another one of the really important ideas that you work through in the book, which is this, as you put it, fundamentally intractable evolutionary paradox. Human beings are biologically driven then to form these intimate emotional bonds. But our wiring has a tension between these two competing systems. On one hand, it's what we're talking about, emotional intimacy and pair bonding. But then there's also the drive that we have for sexual novelty and exploration. So let's bring that into the picture here. Talk about how that complicates things.
Yeah, and it complicates things an awful lot.
It sure does.
And it was, and you're right, and it was one of the themes really throughout The Intimate Animal, throughout the book, I was playing with these tensions between love and sex, or between social monogamy and sexual monogamy.
Right.
So let's unpack that.
Yeah.
And when I talk about monogamy as a biologist, and this is, I think, back to something you asked me earlier, Doug, it's the framework of having a lens of an evolutionary biologist for thinking about our intimate lives today. One of the things that I thought was so interesting is I was working on questions of social monogamy, and a lot of my colleagues were starting to ask questions about non-monogamy, consensual non-monogamy, polygyny, polyamory. Mm. And I remember thinking, you know, this is really interesting. A lot of human behavioral scientists, you just use the word monogamous relationship. And I remember saying to a colleague of mine, who's a social psychologist, she said, yeah, of course. I was like, but what does that mean? Like, what does that mean to you? And she was like, what are you talking about? And I said, you know, as a biologist, we don't talk about monogamy in one monolithic sense. We talk about two distinct aspects.
Right.
There's the relationship structure, which is social monogamy, and then there's fidelity, which would be sexual exclusivity. Mm. And in much of the animal kingdom, we understand that many animals that form socially monogamous bonds, so as we said, 3 to 5% of mammals, but about 15% of primates, about 90% of birds. Birds have a different genetic system than humans, but 90% of birds are socially monogamous, at least for a breeding season. Many of them are not lifelong. And when that behavior happens, there can be what we call extra pair copulation or infidelity, mm-hmm. or there's not always this sexual exclusivity with the pair bond partner. Some species do. Genetic studies show us that some species do. So we have to talk about them separately. So we started to apply that framework to our studies on humans and start saying, like, okay, let's really think about social monogamy, relationship structure, that is the most common relationship structure we see around the globe and in human evolution. We form these intense pair bonds, not always lifelong. Sometimes we move on to a new one. Some researchers talk about serial monogamy, for instance. But they can be lifelong. They are in many cases. So that's social monogamy. That's the structure of the relationship. And then this question of sexual fidelity. And what I'm interested in, and the theme that I grapple with throughout the book, is our desires for this close connection, for that social monogamy, but also our desires for sexual novelty and variation.
Yeah.
Turns out that both of those were selected for. This is the great paradox, that we were selected. We saw evolutionary pressure to engage in these deep bonds with someone that we can weather storms with, we can weather life with, we can survive and indeed thrive with. But then also this evolutionary pressure for finding novelty and excitement.
How? Why would that be? Why would both of these impulses make sense in an evolutionary sense?
Yeah. I think the reason is that having the bond, the social relationship, social monogamy, that gave us someone to weather uncertainty in all sorts of ways. That includes the environment, that includes social context and ecology.
Yeah.
To migrate around the globe, to unpredictable food resources, all sorts of things. And then eventually to...
But then it gives you someone to cheat on.
Exactly. And that's the rub.
Yeah.
And that's the part that it's you, we can violate those. And in fact, betrayal in a lot of different societies can be quite extreme, the response to betrayal. And that's true in animals as well.
Yeah. Well, you dig into that in the book for sure. Yes.
Yeah. And I use this one example of where I remember watching red-winged blackbirds in upstate New York, and they were male and female were mated, and the male flew away. And the male next door came over and tried to mate. And when the first male came back, the two of them started fighting and grappling, and they fell right into the water, and only one of them emerged.
Wow.
And but a reminder of the risks of infidelity, not just for red-winged blackbirds, but for humans as well. So then separately, we also have a mechanism, another lever. We have the lever for the deep social bonds, and then we have this lever and selection pressure for variety. And that desire for variety also served us. It served us by having genetic diversity, exploring opportunities, seeing where maybe you could find a better mate or just a different mate. I don't think it's always necessarily one that is quote unquote better. So that lever exists also in the natural world, but it comes at a cost. And I think when we understand that, and not to jump too far ahead, but I think once we understand that there are those two levers, then we're left with this question or this challenge. And I think understanding it, one of the reasons I wanted to write this book or really think about the science is when we understand it, on the one hand, we could be in a relationship and find ourselves straying or our partner straying, or at least starting to look a lot outside because we're craving variation and novelty and something new. For some people, they open up their relationships. They have ways that structure relationships that are negotiated non-monogamy or consensual non-monogamy. Doesn't work for everyone, works for some people.
Sure.
And then for others, I think this is the great opportunity when we know the science. We could say, I can take my desire for novelty and variation, and rather than it be a strain on my relationship, I'm going to pull that desire in. And in the context of my partnership, with my partner, we're going to do novelty. We're going to, whether it's sexual novelty, whether it's talking and doing something new in the bedroom, or we're taking a new vacation, or we're cooking a new meal, or we're going out to a new restaurant, whatever it is, we're going to take our desires for novelty and infuse it into the relationship so we combat boredom, because we know that if we just let it sit, it can drift, it can pull us apart. That's why I get so excited about this research, because I think when we know it, we can harness it to enjoy our relationships in more profound ways.
Justin Garcia, his book is called The Intimate Animal: The Science of Sex, Fidelity, and Why We Live and Die for Love. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Justin Garcia. He's the director of the Kinsey Institute. His new book is called The Intimate Animal. There are a lot of myths that you debunk that don't really fit when, as you say, you put it under the magnifying glass of biological and behavioral science. Just a few quick ones. You mentioned the idea that there's this myth that passion dies eventually once we start to nest. That's a myth. That the idea of, you know, there's lust and limerence and we're all excited and that eventually just goes away. And you say that's a myth. That's not true. It doesn't have to be true, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be true. And in fact, the nesting part, what's interesting is we know that when you move in with partners and people who cohabitate, you learn all sorts of new dimensions about each other, whether that's regularly co-sleeping together, whether that's having new opportunities to connect. But I think those are the moments that when the late Dr. Ruth Westheimer, my friend, the wonderful Dr. Ruth, she would talk about sexual literacy, that we just didn't have like the language and the basic education around sexuality. I think that's true of relationships. We lack relationship literacy. So what that means is that when we build a nest with someone, that we're just operating on mythology. We're operating what we've seen on TV or what we think it should happen.
Yeah.
And when that happens, it's so easy to miss the opportunities. It's so easy to miss opportunities of, you know, you move in with a new partner. There are so many opportunities to form new rituals, to form new things that are unique to the two of you, to find new ways to connect, to build your home, structure your home in ways that make it your life fun and that you can engage with each other. And you need some tools to do that. And part of what we found in our studies, including on long-term passion with my colleague Dave Frederick, we did these studies on what keeps passion alive in a sample of heterosexual couples, then also in gay men couples and lesbian women couples. And we found a suite of things. And a lot of it was around communication. And for me, a big part of that is that I think we have to keep in mind that in any relationship, there's three entities. There's me, there's you, and there's us. And how do we continue to cultivate and be curious about that? For me, communication is about cultivating curiosity, not just saying like, hey, honey, how's the weather today? Or like, what'd you do at work today, Doug? But no, like what's weighing on you? Or what do we need to do as a couple? What do you think our relationship needs? And when we think about those three entities and honoring them and cultivating them, that the nest becomes this place of passion and excitement and novelty that I think we can have our cake and eat it too in that sense. I'm optimistic about that.
You write about, and we talked a little bit earlier about some of those cultural changes that have altered, you know, relationship environments. You mentioned the agricultural revolution and urbanization, and you write about that in the book. And then we talked a little bit about dating technologies and the digital revolution, but I wanted to ask just a little bit more about that. When you look at social media, I mean, you write about, for example, the importance of being face, actual physical touch, being face to face with a partner on a date, when you're, you know, passing, you know, pheromones, actual things, senses you can detect, and whatever is in the spit when you're kissing, you know, when you're passing this stuff along, like what is technology, social media, that's disconnecting us from that? Is it going to be so powerful as to short circuit some of these evolutionary instincts that we have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think more and more, as all of us are thinking more and more about the role of technology and social technologies in our social lives and in our intimate lives, I think on the one hand, I'm optimistic about one part of it, and that's that the extraordinary opportunity that comes with these technologies. And I think that includes dating apps and dating websites. I know that there's a lot of folks are hating on them at the moment, but I do think they come with an extraordinary opportunity that you can find someone. If we use these as meeting apps, you can find someone of a particular religion, with a particular allergy, with a particular hobby, with a particular kink, whatever you're looking for. There are ways to search through the more than 100 million singles in the country to find ones that you have something in common with, that you're looking for. For many people, the dating apps are also safer. There's evidence that LGBTQ people, for instance, find it safer to use dating apps and websites than, let's say, walking into a bar in a lot of places in the country and world. And we also, in a study we did not long ago on a multinational study in countries that had less gender egalitarianism, and in our sample it was India and Turkey, women in those countries preferred dating apps and websites because they felt that they had a little bit more control. It was a little safer for them in terms of fear of violence that could happen. So I think there is a lot of opportunity that comes with these apps, but there's also a lot of challenges. There's things like sexual harassment that happen way too often. And then there's something I think that was what you're hinting at, and that's that the technology in some ways isn't really well suited for the human brain.
Yeah.
And there's two challenges that I see that I think particularly impact our romantic and sexual lives. One is the sheer amount of data. And this is the big issue with dating apps, is that you go on these apps and you can find all sorts of people. And you see someone who's interesting. And I think what happens, what I know is happening too often, is that we have a sense of an unlimited resource. So you connect with someone and you say, well, but you have a typo in that third paragraph. And I'm really a stickler for grammar. And so, you know, this isn't going to work. We only do that. The only reason we do that is because the brain thinks, hey, you can get back on your app and there's a few thousand more people to swipe through. Someone there hasn't made that grammatical error. Now, We can also take a step back and say, you're saying no to someone because where they placed a comma? Like, that's crazy. Like, on the face value, that's crazy. It's a typo in a little prompt. But we put so much weight on every small thing we find that's wrong. We really hone in on the problems. We hone in on reasons to say no. The reason we hone in on reasons to say no, it's actually much like how foraging works. When you have this huge food patch, you look for reasons to say no to all the fruit that looks a little bit bruised or a little bit wilted, because you're looking for the perfect one. Well, when we have a sense of thousands and thousands of potential dates on these apps and websites, we keep saying no to people that are otherwise probably great in many ways. So that is this kind of cognitive overload. There's so much data, there's so many options. It makes it really hard for us to focus in. So we just look for reasons to say no and to move on. And I think often, you know, I'm a big advocate, as I wrote about in the book, I'm an advocate of second and third dates. We found that over 70% of people have become deeply attracted to someone they weren't initially attracted to. And that takes time. You know, that takes getting to know someone. The number one thing people want in their date in our Singles in America study is some in a partnership is someone they can trust and confide in. You don't learn that on a first date. It really takes time of engaging, getting to know someone, go on a second and third date. But it's so easy to go on that first date and say, well, the person was great, but they held their fork so funny. And I don't know. I can get on the app and find someone who's not going to hold their fork that funny. Yeah. And we find reasons to just keep looking for perfect. And I don't think that's conducive to building meaningful, satisfying relationships in our lives. So I think that's the one big, big challenge. The other big challenge is that we are distracted. We're so easily distracted by our technologies. And there's an opportunity to use them to connect, but too often they're a distraction. In one of our studies, we asked people, you know, how do you feel if someone puts a phone on the table when you're dating? And people get really upset. They're like, no, just put it away. I want to hone in on you. I want to focus on you in this date. And I think too often these technologies become distractions for us as opposed to finding ways to build deeper connections with each other. So one is too much data, the overload, and the other is that it's distracting. But again, where I'm optimistic is I think when we know that, that's when we can control, we can grab biology by the horns and we could say, okay, I'm on dates. I'm going to put my phone in my pocket. You know what I'm going to do? I'm not going to swipe 1,000 people tonight. I'm going to carefully read profiles and I'm going to see, is there a kernel of something there that's interesting? I'm going to engage. I'm going to send a like. I'm going to send a message. So we can control our biology when we understand where our impulses are taking us.
Let me ask you one more thing. I want you to, I want to ask about this lovely image you invoke toward the end of the book. You write about this experience during, this was in March of 2020, and people will remember March of 2020 as the moment all hell breaks loose with COVID. And you decide to get your parents out of New York City, out of their apartment. And so you are going to pack them up and have them come with you to the Midwest. And you write about this moment as the trip begins, where you're driving past this park in Queens. And on impulse, you pull in. Can you say something about that, finally, that what you see?
Sure. So I grew up in Queens, a Queens boy, and we were driving by Forest Park, and folks who know New York or know Queens know that there's an old, beautiful carousel in Forest Park. And I had my kindergarten birthday party there, and, you know, it was so uncertain and so scary, particularly in Queens, New York, which had become an epicenter of the pandemic. And my parents lived quite close to it. And initially, I was supposed to fly home. I actually had been traveling for work as COVID was landing on our shores. And we said, okay, we're going to drive back. It's not a short drive from Indiana to New York City. And we passed the park and we said, let's take a look. And it was, for me, this really a full circle moment of thinking about being a kid and my love for the natural world, and particularly the carousel, because there was the animals on the carousel, the some that I really loved. And thinking about my mom would take me there and my having my kindergarten birthday party there. And then thinking at this much later stage of life and how in this moment of so much fear and so much uncertainty that having those relationships, having my parents who I cared so much about, having those close bonds. And I thought, we'll weather this. This is scary and it's uncertain, but you know what? We're all in this Jeep together and we'll weather this. And there was something so comforting. I ended the book there because it was this really powerful reminder of love in all its dimensions and how it can heal and protect us and has helped our species survive and thrive for millions of years. And it helps all of us do it still every day.
Justin Garcia, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thrilled to be with you.
Justin Garcia. He's the executive director of the Kinsey Institute, author of the book, The Intimate Animal, The Science of Sex, Fidelity, and Why We Live and Die for Love. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.